Hi, I'm John Paul Beauchamp with ICOM America, and I'm coming to you today with a special interview with a dear friend of mine, Danielle Amet, and she is an equine industry consultant, and this is Radios in Action. Good afternoon, Danielle. Thanks for joining me, and I'm really sincerely appreciative of giving of your time, and I'd like first of all, to say that, you know, you're an equine industry consultant and we've known each other a number of years. Why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and some of your equestrian background?
Sure. Thank you for having me, first of all. Let's see. I like to call myself the the jack of all trades equestrian. So I come with quite a diverse background in the industry, and I keep adding to that as I go. I originally went to Centenary University, got my undergraduate in equine studies, and then ran off from there. So a lot of the beginning of my career began working in training barns. So I was working with horses, working with clients, working with trainers, taking care of the horses and so on. And went to a lot of horse shows during that time as a groom. That's what they're called. And then eventually I decided to transition into more of the business side of the industry. I went back to school, got my MBA. And then that's when I first began selling equine insurance. So I still to this day sell equine and farm insurance. And I've been doing that kind of on the side all along. And then ventured into other things. I started in horse show management, I guess more as a secretary, which is the office work of a horse show, about 10 years ago. It was actually 2014 was the first event that I participated in. So 10 years ago was the first event. And then while I had other jobs and other ventures, I would pick up horse shows here and there to help out and still doing that apparently. So 10 years later. And since then I have done a couple of different jobs. I was at the United States Equestrian Federation for almost 6 years. I was leading the driving sport, which is carriages, horses and carriages. And then I also taught online with Post University's equine program. So I have some background in academics. And then now my new job is with the Mustang Heritage Foundation, working with people supporting the Mustang horse, the wild horses, and bringing them into domestication from the overpopulation that we have out west. So that is what I'm doing now, along with still running events and being a part of that world as well.
Well, I didn't know we had an overpopulation of Mustang horses out west, but I think...
Now you do.
Well, and if we can domesticate them and take care of them and train them and care for them and such things, I think that is obviously much better than any possible less pleasant outcome for these wild animals. So I think that's wonderful that there is this foundation out there. So kudos to the Mustang Heritage Foundation for bringing you on and for giving you this hour to talk to me. So thank you again for that. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about horse shows. Now, as you know, I've been dabbling in equestrian events myself for about 20 or so years. So when we talk about a horse show, the horses could possibly be involved in many different disciplines, right? Can you give me a rundown of the various disciplines that USEF oversees, where you and I crossed paths originally, and you know, maybe we can talk about a little bit how the various horse shows around the country and the numbers, the staggering numbers that are out there, and what they involve.
I'm sure. And I definitely did not do fact checking on the exact numbers, so don't quote me per se. But the U.S. Equestrian oversees, I think, around 25, I might be off by a few, but 25 disciplines and breeds. So there are many horse shows within that. I think they license around 2,000 something horse shows a year. And that's just out of those disciplines that they oversee. And then there is an entire Western world that I don't know any of the stats for, but a huge part of our country actually is involved in the Western disciplines. And that involves all kinds from roping, barrel racing, reining, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on. So it's a massive industry. I know the American Horse Council did do a survey somewhat recently, and it's multi-billion-dollar industry in this country to both own horses and run events and be involved in the equine industry. So there's a lot out there.
It is absolutely fascinating once you've dipped your toe in the trough, as it were. Once you've done that, to think that you've got some grasp of what's going on with the various areas of expertise is almost its own level of hubris, because of the vast differences between the disciplines, as well as the vast differences between the horses that participate mm-hmm. and the horse owners, or the team owners, as it were. So with this level of diversity and activity, right, huge amounts of activity in this industry, what percentage of these events are held at, in your opinion, or to your knowledge, are held at permanent venues versus the middle of nowhere USA that is otherwise, you know, event free or used for a different purpose? You know what I mean? Those temporary events. How many?
Yeah,
what's the difference there?
I definitely wouldn't know any numbers, but there's a huge, I would say the larger events you're going to see at permanent venues. Of course, they still kind of move in like a circus, right? Like the event organizers and the team and then the competitors all move in like a circus at an established venue. They run their event and then they take off.
Pack up and go.
Yeah. So a lot of times it's kind of that traveling circus feel, but there are definitely events that will set up in the middle of an open field with no infrastructure whatsoever and just have to build it from scratch. And I would say most of the time, those are your smaller events, maybe your more local based events. But I mean, that's everything from clubs, local clubs, to associations and so on that are putting on these events. So they definitely figure out how to, like I said, move in the circus and build either from scratch or build based off of the infrastructure that's offered at a facility. And so while I don't know numbers, I would say the larger events and larger facilities would probably bring in more of a team, more income, more people, more so on. It's a bigger event. The smaller events may actually be larger in numbers across the board, but they're going to be, of course, a smaller audience, a smaller group of people. So it's kind of here or there. It's a little bit of both, right, with the horse industry.
So more for my audience than yours, because obviously, you know, you have such a tremendous following mm-hmm. across the disciplines. For my audience, what I'd like to clarify is that when we talk about these permanent facilities, we're talking about venues that are perhaps horse parks or mm-hmm. equestrian facilities, but not necessarily huge permanent grandstands and things like that. Very often, these permanent facilities are simply an office and plumbing and electricity that need to be utilized. And still, temporary barns may be brought in. Sometimes there's mm-hmm. permanent barns. Temporary tents for dining and things are brought in sometimes. And other times, there's, you know, tents and campers and things right. like that. And almost always mud. So yes. it's almost a standard.
Yeah.
But so when I explain to my audience about how these events just pop up, And I loved your analogy of like a circus, because we've all been to or seen a circus that pulls into a parking lot and sometimes has electrical infrastructure because there used to be a mall there, or they pull up into what used to be a field and they need to bring in huge generators. Mm-hmm. So where we can't necessarily say 45% of this and 35% of that, right. We can definitely say we're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shows that have some level of infrastructure and even more shows that have no infrastructure.
That's very likely. Yeah.
Obviously, because of my area of specialty, mm-hmm. In this scenario, which would be two-way radio communications, why don't you do me and my audience a favor and help explain the value of bringing in a radio system with multiple channels and mm-hmm. coverage across the event campus? Where's the value and the importance for you as an event organizer?
Well, speed of communication is definitely top of the list. The moment you get set up, the first thing you want is your radios up and running. So the first thing I do is make sure the radios are charged. Right when I get there, radios are charged, because once everyone walks in the door, you want your responsible parties to have that radio. And part of the reason being because, related to what we were just talking about, you're in these venues that may or may not have Wi-Fi, may or may not have good cell phone service, and everyone's coming in with different carriers, different equipment, different so on. And a lot of people are not fast enough on their phones. You know, even though we're all expert texters these days and we're all a phone call away, it's still not fast enough. And frankly, you really need kind of both the speed and the agility of a radio when you're on site with something.
Well, that is one of the things that we in the radio industry tout quite often, and that is the importance of the one-to-many ability. Mm. Right? You're not just calling John Paul to Danielle. You're calling John Paul to anyone who's out in that upper field. You're calling to anyone in the barn, because that's the information you need. In a mm-hmm. different scenario, we may be calling one another to get specific information, sure. and we need to have that flexibility. And therefore, we talk about this all the time in the radio world about how, you know, you can evacuate a school in 3 minutes with radios. Try doing it with cell phones. Mm. Well, I don't have that teacher's telephone number. Oh, I have the teacher across the hall. I have that teacher's telephone. It just doesn't work.
Right. Yeah.
And that translates to all of these scenarios.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So when you set up an event and you plug the radios in and you're charging them and you're all set, how many, I mentioned the need for multiple channels. I talked about the idea of putting infrastructure in place. And in my scenario, that would be repeaters or a trunked repeater system of some kind. When you're speccing that out with whatever organization you're renting from or borrowing from or such, how many channels does the average show? Why would they need more than one channel? How about, let's go down that path.
Okay. Because the how many depends on the size of the event, exactly. Of course, right? So the reason you would need multiple channels would be because you have different audiences you're trying to reach. And to your point of needing to reach multiple people at once, you're going to have your core staff, that is your core organizing staff, that you need to be able to reach easily and quickly. And the things that they're discussing may not be things you want everyone involved in.
More paper for the copier. Who's got the staples?
Or even logistics. You know, it could be logistics. I want to say emergencies, but not in the physical way. But, you know, organizational logistic emergencies.
Absolutely.
Things like that. The behind the scenes stuff that no one else needs to hear or know about. Because every event has a crazy behind the scenes. And on the front, you have to look very, you know, pristine and organized.
Danielle, I've done several hundred events as some level of participant or worker. I don't know what you're talking about. We've never had any
outside, right?
There's never been any rush call to action. There's never been a reason to stay past 5:01 p.m. Everybody gets a good night's sleep. There's never any stress with these things, don't you know?
That's because you have a specific channel for that core staff, isn't it?
That must be what it is. Thank you for that kindness.
So you have different audiences. Like I was saying, you'll have your core staff. You'll have, you know, maybe auxiliary staff that you need to reach. At horse shows, you'll have officials that will have very specific jobs. They also need to not be distracted when they're doing their job, which is judging the horses and watching the horse show. So you need to have some channels clear, some channels where you can communicate with certain people, but not others. You'll have very often a volunteer base that you want specifically to only be on, you know, this channel for these purposes. So there's just different audiences that you have to reach at a horse show. And it's important that the right people are listening to the right things. And especially when you start getting into larger audiences, like volunteers, for example, you don't want them jumping from channel to channel. You want them, okay, here's your clear instruction. You're going on this channel, you stay on that channel, and then you know you're getting the information you need. Whereas someone like the organizer, I usually have three radios sitting around me at all times because I have to listen to all those channels all at once and be a part of all of them. So that would be your main reason for needing multiple channels, is your levels of audiences, you know, that you're working with.
So when you're planning all of this out, how important is it to have those meetings well in advance so that you can spec that, if you will, with your radio provider?
Well, you know, most events that have been up and running kind of know what their needs are and know, you know, where the pitfalls have been in the past. If you're trying to figure out a new event, the organizer would really need to think through that and come up with that plan beforehand. You don't ever want to get to an event and realize that your radios are not up to par with what you need, whether that's number of channels or whether it's not reliable enough or it can't reach the distance that you need at an event or can't go through concrete if you're in an indoor facility. You know, all of those needs really should be thought of long before you're making that rental.
That's a really good point. You know, there's a lot of radios that are available that you can buy. You know, we call them bubble pack radios that work just fine as long as you can see each other up to the top of the hill. But as soon as you exceed that range, you lose the clarity or the reliability. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they work over the hill and sometimes they don't. But how do you know? And you don't know.
Right.
So that's where the testing of things come into play. One of the greatest examples of success that we've had at ICOM with supporting the driving industry specifically is an event down in Ocala, Florida, where we use our LTE radios. The beautiful thing there is across the street from the event, there's a tower that has the correct, if you will, cell phone systems on it, and they're not a sponsor of the show, and they're not paying me, so I'm not going to say their name. So they're not on, you know, but they're on the tower, and our radios work great on that venue, and we've tested it over the years and years and years and years. But honestly, if the broadband radio didn't work there, we would go to a more traditional RF system. So when we start thinking about 20, 30, 40, 50 acres sometimes. And that's before we even get into those 100-mile endurance rides where you need all that range and you need all that data even to track GPS positioning things. Mm-hmm. When does that testing have to happen on a new show or when you're changing radio platforms? It doesn't happen the weekend of the show, because how could that happen?
No, I mean, I would say if weeks, if not months in advance, right? Like you, if you're not familiar with the facility, then you would definitely want to go on site, see those logistics of the facility. What distances are we working with? You know, what barriers are there in between? I would say weeks, if not months ahead.
That's what we encourage a lot of our dealers to do whenever they're renting radios or selling radios to any event or venue, we want them to go out there and do that walking test, get on a carriage, get on a horse and go check things out and see how they perform. And that's really the expertise that organizations are paying for when they rent that equipment. Mm-hmm. I've talked to some people who do what you do in terms of running an event. And they said, oh, we just call up XYZ company. They send us a box of radios. And I said, well, how do you know they're going to work? Well, we don't. I said, oh, how does that work? Well, they get here and we hope and we pray. So we want to encourage our audience to be a little more thorough than that. And because of what you've said, hopefully they'll understand the need for that thoroughness. Mm-hmm. When you're doing an event and you've got three radios in front of you and somebody is trying to call you, how do you know which radio, how do you decide which radio it is that they're, how do you know? Is it just the positioning on the table? Is it by volume? How do you know?
So I will have one radio turned up as the important one, the loud one. And that way, it blasts me in the face. It's very loud when someone needs to reach me. Then I'll usually have the other channels on a lower volume, just kind of existing in the background. And I'll only pay attention when, you know, I realize something's going on or, you know, there's,
or you hear your name.
Yeah, I hear my name or hear some problem. And I go, oh, yeah, hang on, turn that one up. Okay, turn that one down. But generally speaking, I do want actually someone in charge of each of those channels. Someone needs to own and be responsible for one of those channels. So whether you have a control that's kind of monitoring the volunteers, for example, or if I'm in the office and I'm the main organizer or secretary, whoever's put in charge of that. I think the key to managing the communications over multiple channels is make sure you have a key person in charge. And that should not be the same person, right? Unless it's a small event where you can handle all of that coming at you. But especially with larger events, you want to have people responsible for it. That way, when someone calls out, let's say a volunteer notices something or finds a problem or has a question or an issue, the question doesn't just go out there to the void. You have someone who's going to go, oh, I got your question. I'll handle it. I'll answer it. I'm responsible for making sure everything is followed up on this channel. So I think everyone knowing their role, knowing what they're responsible for, is an incredibly important part of managing your channels and your communications on site. And speaking about it, you know, making sure there's a plan that anything regarding this goes to this person and that person will answer those things. Anything regarding this goes to that person and they will answer those things. And then if a volunteer doesn't know who to call, that's okay because they can put the question out there and the person who's responsible will go, here I am, I'm picking it up, I got you.
So how much of this, in your opinion, and I know that you're enormously active and you travel and you do different things, how much of this, in your opinion, translates to a 10K, a cross-country meet, or a mud run, or a car race, or any of those outdoor temporary pop-up events? In your opinion, how much of this is how many of the same rules apply?
Yeah, I would think it's very relatable. And I think it's actually more relatable to a size of an event than what is happening at the event, right? So the smaller events are going to have fewer people running them and then fewer people there, you know, helping. So you're going to have a smaller event will have a smaller volunteer base or smaller, you know, staff, whatever that may be. And larger events, I think it's very applicable from horse shows to any other type of event or discipline. I do think horse shows tend to be in broader spaces than your typical event. But, you know, like you were saying, a foot race, for example, would cover a pretty broad space. So I think that's very relatable there.
Right.
Now you may have less volunteers, because I know horse shows in general, just, I mean, we're talking on top of the staff and the officials that come in, which are probably ranging anywhere from 10 to 30 people just on the staff alone and the officials. Then you're adding in volunteers that could be anything from 20 to 70 or 80 people. So I don't know how many people are coming in for other events and how that's relatable or comparable.
Sure. But
I know that I think it's more related to the size. Again, going back to, there are some large events that will use hundreds of volunteers and some events that will use less. So either way, I think all the same principles apply and all the same rules apply. And the larger you get, the more people you're managing, the more it matters that you're organized, that you have the responsible parties, you know, stepping in, and that you're clear in your communications. The more people you add, the more that matters.
Another love of mine, other than just the event, the equestrian events, traditionally usually the driving events, has always been the Special Olympics. And I very often, when I talk about different events and when I supported other events, I talk about the Special Olympics in comparison, because they're usually closer in proximity to one another, the various events around a track or around a field. But it's also very similar in the sense that, you know, there's people at various levels. There's your medical team, there's your organizing team, there's your refreshment team, and then there's the long jump folks that need to be able to talk to somebody back at the scoring arena. So it, to me, the temporary events like that translate seamlessly, especially across those lines. So to hear you say it as the equestrian industry expert helps me very much when I'm talking to my audience, if you will, my dealers and my two-way radio end users, to get them to understand that once they build a solution, it can be replicated for a lot of different disciplines.
Sure. Right. Yeah, I mean, whether it's sports or even you know, events like weddings, for example. I mean, the way weddings are being produced these days, it's a production with, you know, the bells and whistles and all that. And I swear it's not that different.
Well, like everybody, when you bring up wedding, everybody wants to be Franz from Father of the Bride with the headset and be able to talk to somebody. But I think more often than not, we wind up being Jack from you know what I mean? Sean Hayes and his character, where he had the headset, but it wasn't plugged into anything. So, you know, you can never be too prepared, I suppose. I don't know. But I do appreciate your time. We've been talking with Danielle Amet, who is definitely an equine industry expert. I know you called yourself a consultant, but as in-depth as your knowledge is and your connections are, I'm going to dub you the equine industry expert. And I do appreciate your time today. And I look forward to seeing you soon. I look forward to hearing more about the different events that you're running. Mm-hmm. And if there's ever anything that ICOM America can do for you or your events, I hope you reach out. Thank you so much for your time.